From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 8th at the White House, where President Donald Trump hosted a listening session on the subject of violent gaming, video gaming in particular in this case. The president has made a number of comments about video games in the wake of mass shootings in the past year. He's concerned that video games and gaming in general is desensitizing children to violence. This hour, we want to do several things. First, we want to understand as best we can what we know about violence in gaming as it translates to real-life violence. Beyond video games, let's talk about the creation of gaming and entertainment. Should we expect games to have a societal value? Are we missing the potential value in many existing games? And if we create games overtly designed to be educational or beneficial in some sense, can they find an audience? My guests this hour have a range of perspectives on this. Alex White is here, who is... Owner is still the title of owner. What do you give yourself a title?
I usually use managing partner.
Managing partner, given how the business has sort of evolved, right?
Well, the way it's set up is a co-op. You know, I'm the co-op member who manages it.
Okay, co-op manager who manages what, by the way? What's the business?
Bulldoze Armory. It's at 891 Monroe Avenue. We're in our 22nd year of providing. Board games, card games, role-playing games, and miniature games to kids of all ages.
Well, thank you for being here, Alex. It's nice to have you back here. Rabbi Dr. Owen Gottlieb is here, Assistant Professor of Interactive Games and Media at RIT. And Owen, you've got right here in front of me, right here, I've got, what is this, a board game and...
We've got two tabletop games. We spoke about them back in December 2015 about how we were working on them. Now they're out on the market, Lost and Found and Lost and Found Order in the Court, two games teaching about medieval religious legal systems. And on the 19th of April, they're going to become part of the collection at the Strong Museum and an event at the Magic Center. So we're very excited that these are out on the market.
Medieval religious legal systems is the fastest growing category in gaming.
For us, it definitely is. And we can talk about the importance of kind of the expansion of the discourse about what people think about religious legal systems and the impetus behind these games maybe during the hour.
Well, congratulations on turning this into reality, and it's great to have you here. Thank you for being here. Also
great
here,
to be back.
Jennifer Hinton is Assistant Director of the RIT Magic Center. And Jennifer, welcome to the program to you.
Thank you.
And Victoria Van Voris is a CEO of Second Avenue Learning. Tell our listeners what Second Avenue is.
Second Avenue just celebrated its 12th birthday earlier this month, and the focus of Second Avenue is to harness digital media to produce better learning outcomes for students in the K-12 and higher ed markets. We develop simulations, interactives, and lots of serious games, and we've been funded by the National Science Foundation and the Department of Ed to pioneer research in how we can harness the power of games to produce better learning outcomes for students.
And what kind of games in particular, what format are we talking about generally?
Typically PC games. So we've just launched a whole series of physics-based games on Steam to teach middle school students about physics. We have a new augmented reality game that we're partnering with Bach to bring to market through their platform as well as through the Microsoft Store and lots of other new games to come.
I'm looking at the top-selling video games of January 2018, so the newest numbers. And the top five are all pretty violent. Monster Hunter World, Dragon Ball FighterZ, Call of Duty, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, and Grand Theft Auto V. On the list farther down, Assassin's Creed, UFC 3, Rainbow Six Siege, The Need for Speed Payback. These are games with plenty of violence in them. And Victoria, do we overly fixate on violence in video games, or do you think it's important to have that conversation and understand what is dominating the market and what it might mean for kids?
Well, I think that we do tend to fixate too much on violence in video games. Many of the games that you just listed have incredibly high production costs, and they're top sales numbers because they're actually sold at a fairly high price point. And many of the games that are designed for education or casual gaming are much more broadly distributed and are used by a much wider audience of people. The average gamer is 37. More than 50% of games played now are played by women. And so this sort of myth of the nerdy white male gamer in his basement shooting things up is largely that. If you look at any of the data, everybody plays games, whether it's a card game, a word game, or a video game. Humans are designed to learn through play and to socialize through play. And so I think if we reframe the narrative around the kinds of conversations and social interactions we have through games, that that's a much more thoughtful conversation to have.
Can I ask our panel, and I think I'll turn this over to the audience as well, though, not to be too paternalistic about it, but can I just ask if you, I don't know if you have kids at home, but would you let them play these games that top the list of most played video games? Victoria, would you let them play Grand Theft Auto V, Call of Duty, et cetera, et cetera?
That's really tough because I am a mom and I have a game company. And so games are certainly a part of our family's conversation and pattern of play. And some of my older kids certainly do play some of those violent video games. But do those video games teach violence? No, I think all media celebrates, unfortunately, violence in some way, shape, or form. Cinema, books, we have a history of violence as a people, and it's a new art form that is exploring violence in a different way. You don't learn actually how to aim or shoot a gun by playing CSGO or Fortnite or Assassin's Creed. You do have a big social community. Do I support the fact that my kids play some of these violent games? Absolutely not. We have a rule in our house about balancing consumption and creation and learning how to use computers to create and not just consume media. But I think we're not going to be successful in trying to ban that kind of outlet. I think we need to look at encouraging people to play a wide variety of games. I played Scrabble the other night for 2 hours with my 14-year-old, and he went back and played CSGO with some of his friends. I think if we try and too much focus to the exclusion of all other games just on violent video games, we miss the bigger conversation.
Okay. Owen, how do you feel about that list?
I actually teach my undergraduates from Grand Theft Auto V when we're talking about narrative complexity. I mean, Grand Theft Auto V is an interesting game in terms of its satire and commentary. I think there's a question about what's age appropriate. Mm-hmm. It's different for a 15-year-old who's got a sense of satire and story to be playing Grand Theft Auto than a 5-year-old who I would say that's not an appropriate game. So games are art, and so I think about the same questions that I ask about books and cinema, as Victoria was just mentioning. So there's a right time and a right place, and it has to be in the context of family discussions, and everything in moderation as well. So it doesn't change for me too much from, say, cinema.
Okay, Jen?
Agree. And I think this is a perfect opportunity. All of the games that you referenced have an M for mature rating. The fact of the matter is only 11% of the games that are created have that rating. So we're talking about a very small percentage. And like Tori said, produced by large companies. I'm a parent as well, and I'm a parent to a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old. And the game that they really want to play right now is Fortnite. And they want to play Fortnite because their friends are playing Fortnite.
Can you describe it for the listeners like me who have never seen it?
Sure. Well, I will tell you, Fortnite is a game, it's rated T for teen. And like I said, my kids are 9 and 12 years old. And that's the conversation that we have, that even though their friends are playing that, like Owen said, it's a family conversation. We don't play that game in our house. I choose to engage with my kids around play, whether it's board games like Scrabble or Monopoly. My son is really into FIFA, so we bond and play around FIFA on the Xbox. There is a rating system out there for video games similar to movies, and the data also shows that parents are confident that those ratings are accurate and that parents do take those ratings into consideration when they are purchasing those games. So we also know that kids purchase those games on their own. So I think as a parent, one of the things that we can do is engage with our kids about what we're playing and check in with them and play the games that they're playing. If your teenager is playing, Call of Duty, not an appropriate game, and that's a conversation to have at home.
Okay. Alex, how do you feel about those?
Well, I have no kids. So this is all theoretical for me.
Okay.
But, I have, my store doesn't sell video games at all, but there are board games that are similarly violent. And, to try to blame gaming when we live in a society where students are being shot in school, police are shooting friends on the street, and we're conducting one of the largest covert war operations with drones in the history of the world, you know, for the number of people killed, it's hard to blame video games for the problems of violence in our community. And
or board games or gaming.
Right, games in general. Okay. I think that we're talking about, you know, certainly there are video games that I don't think serve any function. There is no, it's all moving your hands and clicking on things. But many games, even that are relatively violent, do have elements in them which allow you to problem solve, force you to engage intellectually into things, and require you to think beyond the trigger. And, you know, there's a lot of learning that goes on in many of these things. Sure, it may not always be the learning we want. And, you know, parents should feel free to say this is inappropriate for you. But in most cases, I think there's plenty of opportunity between fighting parents and violence in our society to come to violent outcomes for children without even blaming the games.
I don't know why I, as a kid growing up, ended up loving games like Civilization and Might and Magic as opposed to more of the shoot 'em up games. That just sort of happened for me. But I look back and I sort of feel glad now as a parent that that was my path. And if I think if my kid wants to get into games, I hope it's more like that and less like the Grand Theft Autos. Though I take Owen's point. I mean, I haven't studied Grand Theft Auto. Maybe there is satire there as he gets older that there may be some sort of artistic value. But it's tough. And I would love to hear from parents as we go throughout this hour, because in a moment we're going to shift much beyond video games just to talk about the wide world of gaming, what some of our guests are creating, what some of the guests believe is the possible value. And whether we can get an audience for that, or if we're sort of missing the point here. But before we do that, we do have to at least address this question, which Alex started to answer, which is, can we blame gaming at all for violence of any kind? The president is worried that we can. And in the wake of the Parkland shooting, that's when he held this listening session at the White House, there may be more of a movement to kind of to regulate anew some of the violence in games. And before we go on, I just want to listen to a little bit of a conversation that NPR's Ari Shapiro had with Douglas Gentile, who is a psychology professor at Iowa State University. He has researched video games and violence. He's kind of taken a look at the many studies that have happened over the years. This was part of their conversation just a few weeks ago after the White House's listening session when it comes to what video games, what violence in media like television, violence in gaming, possible impacts on people.
The research on media violence and aggression seems pretty clear that the more children consume media violence, whether that's in video games, TV, or movies, they do become more willing to behave aggressively when provoked.
You sort of conflated video games, TV, movies there. In a video game, you're pretending to be the shooter. You're interacting with a virtual world. TV or movies is much more passive. Is there an important distinction there, or is violence violence in media, no matter whether it's interactive or passive?
We used to think that video games would have a much larger effect than passive media like TV or movies, but the research has not seemed to bear that out. It seems to be about the same size effect, which is somewhat surprising because they are active and you are being rewarded for it. But basically what we're coming down to is learning. We can learn from all of these different ways, and it seems we don't learn particularly differently from video games than from TV or movies.
Some people have offered a theory that video games can be catharsis, and expressing violent impulses in a virtual world helps people not express those in the real world. Has that been disproven?
That has been disproven. So how do you memorize a phone number? You repeat it. Does seeing it one more time take it out of your brain? That would be the catharsis idea, right? But no, each new time you see it burns it in a little deeper. So in fact, there's no possible way that catharsis can happen, at least not, you know, the way people like to talk about it.
Do you think the premise of this White House meeting is flawed? I mean, should video games be one focus of this debate over gun violence in America?
I do think it's flawed. I think the problem is that we're seeking a simple solution to a complex problem. And I noticed there are no real aggression researchers at this White House meeting. So we're not even getting the real picture. What we're getting is just a very one-sided and very limited look into only one of the risk factors for aggression.
That's NPR's Ari Shapiro speaking to Douglas Gentile, psychology professor at Iowa State University. So, Alex, I want to start with you, and we'll go back around the table here and try to kind of close the loop here and then broaden the conversation. But when it comes to what the White House is doing here, Professor Gentile is not saying there's no possible connection. He's saying it's much more complex than to point to one thing or one video game. But certainly, if it's not violence that is engendered by this, sometimes aggression levels go up, and we should probably think about that. So I wonder how you view the complexity of violence in gaming and this conversation about mass shootings, this conversation about societal culture.
You know, I think there is some connection. I mean, the question really is, how big is the connection? And how direct is the connection? Because many times, you know, people respond to seeing the violent images on movies in very different ways. And some people see that and actually decide they have to avoid that actions. You know, people are very complex, and they're trying to simplify this to an extreme level. And they're trying to draw these incredibly broad comparisons without looking at the, you know, children are exposed to hundreds of influences an hour. And, you know, if you think that video games are having a bigger influence on aggression than, for example, their parents yelling at each other or their dog dying or, you know, something like that, you're just completely out of bounds on this. That's ridiculous.
Alex, you also have experience with politics, and I wonder, do you see the tinge of politics in what the White House is doing? In other words, could this be a scapegoating effort designed to mask any calls for new gun reform?
God, yes. I mean, there's just no way around this. This is the man who is ordering deaths on a daily basis, going out and saying, it's video games. Look, it's video games that are the problem. You know, we can't have a mature conversation about guns and gun violence in our country, and he's not even willing to start this sort of mature conversation, and yet he's more than willing to scapegoat anything else because it's safer, and then we don't have to deal with the two sides that will be polarized by talking about guns.
Okay. Jen, how do you feel about the question on linking violence to video games, to gaming in general, whether it's productive to even, you know, to try to suss that out in a complex picture?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the research, you know, points to the fact that there is no linkage. We at RIT are part of a larger organization called the Higher Education Video Game Alliance, and known as HEVGA. HEVGA has released a statement stating that, and this is a group of educators who study games around the country. I think the challenge that we're facing right now is that video games are the form of expression for this generation, and we are pointing a finger at that.
Okay. Owen?
Yeah, I was going to, if we looked at the HEVGA statement, actually, it cites the Supreme Court ruling in 2011 that kind of puts video games in the same space as books and other media, noting that there is no connection, you know, in the psychological studies in terms of the exposure to violent video games and harmful effects on children, and that the effect sizes are very small, and it's similar to if you were to watch, you know, Bugs Bunny or the Roadrunner, and that they fade away very quickly. And thinking about what the scholar was saying on the phone earlier, I think, well, If we went to see Macbeth two or three times in a row, then I'm going to want to pick up a sword. It kind of doesn't follow to me in terms of watching violence that we've been doing for thousands of years and that we certainly don't question in terms of Shakespeare, Hamlet, Macbeth. But if it's in a video game, it's different. I would also question, and I do this with my students, to say the notion that you're a passive viewer when you're in the theater or when you are watching cinema, you are doing all kinds of cognitive work. And so the notion that you are not interactive or passive, it's just you're interactive in a different way, and it's maybe more quiet, and it's not using a controller to do it. But there's certainly a lot of cognitive activity going on. So I have real issues with this notion that's where violence comes from.
Okay, Victoria.
I think if we go back and we look at the WHO report, which is one of the things that kicked off this conversation anew, the WHO report really asked us to consider this linkage for a very small percentage of the population, people who had personalities that were primed for addiction. And so that is a very small percentage of the population. And what percentage of people who have that sort of temperament that allows them to become more easily addicted might pick video games, they might pick gambling, they might pick drugs or alcohol. And I don't think we can make a linkage from there to violent expression with actual physical guns. I think that is a conversation that needs to be addressed from a mental health perspective, from a gun control perspective, from a legislative reform perspective, not necessarily just looking at the media that, as Jen said, is the medium of expression for this particular generation.
All right, let me grab a couple of phone calls, and then in our second half hour, our guests are going to tell you more about their thoughts I'm very curious to know if someone like Owen Gottlieb, who's helped develop this lost and found order in the court about medieval religious
legal systems
and the learning that can come from that. Is the goal one day just to get into the marketplace to find niches, or is the goal to create, is the goal for Second Avenue to sort of supplant those top-selling games, or just to kind of be part of it? Alex White, we're going to talk about the kind of games that are played in Baldo's Army every day and whether there's more value than we might realize already, or in general in games. So there's a lot of different angles to this coming up here. Let me grab a couple of phone calls. First, John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. I was going to say, I think this meeting they're going to have at the White House, I think it's too narrow. I think they shouldn't just focus on video games. To me, just seems a little bit narrow. I think they should look at the whole entertainment industry. And I'll give you an example. I saw a movie recently on HBO. I couldn't watch the whole thing, but by chance, there was a scene. Samuel L. Jackson and Colin Firth were in it, and I can't remember the name of it. But there was a scene where Colin Firth goes into a church and with a semi-automatic gun kills everybody in the church, along with there were some knife scenes also. And there probably 50 or 60 people were killed, and I couldn't believe that was on the movies. And that's the type of thing I think really has an impact. Video games would be part of it. The other thing I was going to say is I heard on a radio program, I'm not sure which one, that there was a study done in New Jersey of school children, and I think they had them playing violent video games. And then they did a test on how quickly they had a play gun or something. And the kids that watched the violent movies were more apt to press the gun by 200 or 300% more on the trigger. So I don't know if your panel has heard anything about that.
So, but John, wait, I want to ask you a quick question. Are you still there, John?
Yep.
So as a parent, I'm with you. I sit there, I can't even believe if my son wants to watch a Cleveland Cavaliers basketball game for a quarter or two with me, that we've got to wade through commercials are violent. I mean, I'm amazed at how much violence.
It's unbelievable.
I'm with you in many ways there, John. What I want to ask you, because I know a little bit about your politics, do you want to see it regulated, or do you want a cultural conversation where Hollywood simply doesn't do this as much?
Well, what I'd like to see is this. Tom DiNapoli has pulled the strings on investing in polluting carbon oil companies, that type of thing. I'd like to see the government and pension funds pull the funding from the entertainment industry. I don't want to see them legislate against them. That would be, I think, a trampling on freedom of speech. But I think you can boycott, you can pull investments, pension fund investments, out of the entertainment industry, stop the tax credits for the movie industry in New York State. That's a good example. That would be a good example of putting pressure on the movie industry in that regard, but not to legislate.
Okay, so boycotts in many ways. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the phone call. Some thoughts is it too narrow a focus? I mean, it doesn't. Owen, you were sort of a skeptic on video games in general being, a cause of violence. Do we need to look at wider media?
Books. Let's look at books. We should not have books that have violent scenes in them. I'm being facetious a little bit, but that's kind of how I'm thinking. If you're reading a martial arts scene in a book, it's going to be violent. I mean, we're here because we love play and because we learn from play. I think most of the people around the table here are people who see the value in learning in play. I don't want to talk for everybody, but that's the sense I get. And part of play is imagination, and part of play is using your imagination to come up with ideas. So, I'm not someone who tends to say, you shouldn't imagine something. If you're going to hurt someone, that's very different, and that's what we have to teach young children. But I think even, you know, teens, for the most part, unless they're in need of real serious care, understand the difference between play and not play.
So we're talking about violence in gaming and whether it translates to real life violence and what our guests are doing in various ways to maybe foster a gaming world that creates a better society, I guess. I mean, Alex White, what is the most popular game played at Baldur's? Is it Magic the Gathering?
It's Magic
still?
The Gathering.
It still is Magic the Gathering.
Still the Magic, yeah.
What's the most violent character in Magic the Gathering?
You know, if you think about what is actually going on in the game, you are using proxy monsters to do 20 points in damage to another player. Okay? That's an entirely violent concept. But if you talk to most of the players, they're not seeing that. What they're seeing is a bunch of cool pictures and they're
good artwork in many
good
ways.
Artwork. They're trying to see how the cards interact with each other to produce
they're doing
condition.
Math.
They're doing math. By the way, I have 10-year-olds who have memorized roughly 5,000 cards text on them, some of them 5 sentences long. The amount of reading a kid doing magic is doing has so much value just in that. And when you watch these young kids, and, you know, sure, they're doing very simple math. They're subtracting and adding single digits from another number. And they're doing it in their head so fast that, you know, we're giving calculators to kids in school, and I have, this Friday, I will have a dozen kids sitting there doing math in their head. And, you know, the value that can be gotten out of this and, you know, reading alone, the whole concept that, you know, it's very difficult to get kids to want to read in many cases. And anyone introduced to magic that likes it will then sit down and not realize that they have just read large books, you know, to get them to where they want to be playing the game.
This is part of the conversation that says we think about kids and reading maybe too narrowly, Alex.
You know, when I used to teach 25 years ago, and there was this concept at the time of whole language, which was, it doesn't matter what kids read, just get them to read, okay? And this concept that if they're reading anything, they're improving their vocabulary, they're improving their skills, it doesn't so much matter what they're reading. Yes, it's a pity the classics are not what everyone wants to sit down and read, but if they're reading, they're reading, and it's improving them. And, you know, I have kids come in, and I have binders of cards, and they will sit there and turn the pages reading every card on there to see if there's anything that works in their latest deck. And the question they asked me is, what works with this? How can I combine this? The thought process that's going on in these kids is so intensely valuable. You know, and you'd think, you know, it's got to be all smart kids coming into my store, which is completely untrue. We have a lot of kids from very challenged families in, because I'm right in the city. And I have people walk to my store who are going to city schools and come from very challenging family situations. And they're at the same level as the good kid from Brighton or Pittsford. So, you know, gaming.
I think Alex is being cheeky when he says good kid too, by the way.
Well, yes, I am.
You're being stereotypical for effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But we have these, I see this all the time, that, you know, just participating in gaming helps young kids tremendously in their math and reading skills, which wears off in school. And I have had kids who came in younger, very young, and were not good students, and in some cases were failing, and 5 years later they're on the honor roll. And gaming has a part of that.
Okay, everyone wants to jump in. Go ahead, Victoria.
Well, actually, what your observation was shared by James G., who used to be on faculty at U Wisconsin, is now out at ASU. He recognized that young students who were considered behind had memorized entire decks of Pokemon cards and were reading at an eighth grade level when they were in third grade. So the research backs your observation about the powerful impact of playing many different kinds of games has on improving students' reading scores. It also invites them into a problem space where they have an opportunity to experiment and try different things and strategize and problem solve in a very de-risked way. So in school, it's perform or get a bad grade. In the world of play, you can play with those same topics in a non-punitive fashion. So you can, you know, add up your points in a game, and it doesn't matter if you get it right or wrong because you're playing in a game, but you're motivated to do so. It's very different from sort of the rigid assessment-based system that we have in place right now in our schools. And it actually taps into both intrinsic and extrinsic motivation when you're playing a game. So you're actually more motivated to get this stuff right and experiment, explore, and strategize and problem solve.
Okay, Owen?
I was going to follow up and say there's a study that goes back to around 1986 that was looking at fifth grade boys and advanced D&D manuals. And so you had fifth graders, self-directed learning, who are reading at a college or higher reading level because they're passionate about what they're trying to solve and they're interested. And so from a literacy perspective, we're talking now 3 decades of understanding that this goes on when people have self-directed learning. So just to kind of piggyback on the last two pieces.
I want to grab one phone call and then we'll get our only break and we'll come back and talk to our guests about the individual projects that they've been working on and what you ought to know about what the gaming world might look like if we get beyond just that top 5 or top 10 selling video games that we often sort of cartoonishly look at with violence. This is Joanne in Rochester. Go ahead, Joanne.
Hi. My view is that a lot of the violence we see is an expression of an inner drive that starts to build just prepubescence, especially in boys. And our current society doesn't really give that outlet. So even these games that are played digitally are not in balance with the entire hormonal system. There needs to be an accompanying physical element to help them express their full energies at that point in their development. The other thing I want to mention is our society has somewhat delegated often boys to be in an environment of mostly women. And I do think boys need to be around men with a objective, a goal, a task that gives them self-confidence. And we found in, for example, animals, when young males are in the presence of older males of their species, the older male, just the presence of their testosterone helps suppress the aggressive tendencies in the young male. So, you know, it's great to have lots of women tending over young boys, but the presence of men, especially in a physical activity, will help them control some of their impulses. Hmm. And I think one problem of the digital games is that it just doesn't allow them to get their adrenaline moving and to burn out that energy. So it gets bent up when you have industry like movies, which want to present aggression. That's always going to be very attractive to males who have no outlet for this testosterone-driven drive. Hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for the phone call, Sandra. Some interesting thoughts there. Anyone want to respond to that? Rabbi, go ahead.
Yeah, I think definitely, in my opinion, if you're playing video games, you should also be outdoors, involved in sports, physical activity. You know, there are certain video games that now, as we're moving into VR, especially, that will involve more embodied play. But moderation in everything. So if you're only doing one thing, if you were only doing sports and not reading a book, if you were only playing Grand Theft Auto 5, but not out, you know, in the woods sometimes, that's going to be a problem. So I appreciate, you know, what that caller was talking about and needs for balance, I think, not just in video games, but in life.
And by the way, thank you, Joanne, for the phone call. I appreciate that. Let me go ahead and get our only break of the hour. And we're talking to an interesting panel about the subject of video games, board games, gaming in general, possible impact on violence, and how to create games, if that's one of our goals, that actually are appealing to the market that have societal values, educational values, and others built into them. You just heard Rabbi Dr. Owen Gottlieb, who is Assistant Professor of Interactive Games and Media at RIT. Jennifer Hinton is Assistant Director of the RIT Magic Center. Victoria Van Voris is CEO of Second Avenue Learning. And Alex White is the owner of Baldo's Armory. Let's get that only break and come back right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we are coming up on the start of state testing season, and we'll talk a little bit about opt-outs, but you're going to hear a conversation that we appreciated from a woman who is a poet who had a question on a standardized test about one of her poems, and she didn't even know the answer. We'll talk to her about that experience and get a snapshot of standardized testing. It's Tuesday. All right, welcome back to Connections. I've got this idea about games, and our guests are about to tell me if I'm right or wrong, that there's basically two categories. There are companies that create games that they want to sell a billion copies of if they can, and then there is the creation of games that are going to be niche, but they're made in an educational sort of framework and drive, and if they're successful, they're not going to supplant the top 10 list. But they're going to sell enough copies, they'll sustain, they will make a dent in the educational setting, maybe they will be used in classes at times. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Owen Gottlieb helped create Lost and Found Order in the Court because you want to sell a billion copies. Is that framework wrong, or am I right there?
I would say I am in a niche. I would love to sell a billion copies of Lost and Found.
Who doesn't
Lost
want to?
Lost and Found Order in the Court. That would be great. But I would say, you know, I come from a background that is a mix of a number of disciplines. I talk about learning sciences. And so part of what we're trying to do with the research at the Initiative in Religion, Culture, and Policy at the Magic Center is to learn about learning and to try to make a difference in terms of people's literacy with regards to comparative religion, to have an understanding of how people's hand down their cultures and use games and simulations to do that, and to have impact in formal and informal educational settings and in policy. So, you know, these are games about trying to widen the discourse. When we talk about a religious legal system, what are we talking about? So these games are set in Fustat, North Africa, Old Cairo in the 12th century, the time of Moses Maimonides, the great rabbi, physician, scholar, philosopher, as he's writing his great law code, the Mishnah Torah. And he is, in fact, influenced by great Islamic jurisprudence, Averroes and Al-Ghazali. It's an amazing crossroads of religious peoples meeting at the same time. And what we learn about these legal systems is that they are about promoting collaboration and cooperation and a governance system and community sustainability. And so our game, the first game is a strategic game in which we balance the needs of the community with the needs of the family. How do you do that with limited resources? And the second game is about thinking about how laws might have gotten to the court in the first place about legal reasoning. So how do we make trade-off decisions, and how can a legal system support that in a community-sustaining way? And then how are law systems built? And then we're really in-depth in terms of detail and historical accuracy and trying to bring these periods to life for educators to wrap into their curriculum or for people and families to play at home.
This is beautifully crafted. I mean, the game looks great.
Thank you. That's RIT student illustrators, and we have about 30 students who've worked on these games and scholars from around the country, both at RIT, Harvard Divinity School, Vanderbilt University. We've got a great team of people that are working on these games.
But you're not going to sell it if it's not first and foremost fun.
It has to be fun. We have a dual,
right?
Yeah, we have a dual design problem. One is the game has to be engaging. Sometimes games are not fun in the "hey, happy" sense, but really intense concentration.
Yeah, sure.
So they must be engaging. And then we have a second design problem, which is they have to have underlying learning within them. And so I turn to people like Jan Plass's work at NYU, talking about what are the essential learning behaviors. So what we try to do is take the game mechanics that are underlying the game, what do you do each turn as a player to get closer to your goal, and make sure that those are aligned with our learning goals. So in Lost and Found, tough trade-off decisions about community and family, how you take care of your family and the community at the same time. And then in Order in the Court,
working through legal reasoning problems.
Is this, does it have any analogs in popular gaming? I mean, have you learned anything from other popular games?
Definitely. I mean, I think that we've been very influenced by games like, Lost and Found, we've taken a lot from Euro games. So you may have played Settlers of Catan or heard about it. Pandemic is a great hobby game that's a collaborative game. So we definitely look to best of form in the for-profit world. And then with regards to Order in the Court, you might have played Apples to Apples or Cards Against Humanity fun party games. And so we definitely look to genres. I call it genre immersion when I'm teaching students about how to make good games.
And if somebody picks up and plays this game and they play it for the weekend with friends, they play it at a party, number one, your goal is for them to say, that was fun,
yes.
I would think. Number two, they have learned something?
Yes, they've learned something, and they may think about things slightly differently. I would love for someone to say, when someone says something about, this religious legal system, this, Sharia law, that. Well, I played a game in 12th century North Africa, and the law systems were about taking care of your neighbor. So trying to make, plant those seeds. And I think as we work with educators to build out the curriculum for these games, you can get so many deep hooks. History, look at the coinage, the garments, all the kind of historical accuracy. And then ask questions like, what did it feel like when your neighbor didn't return your cow to you? How did that feel? Why do you think the law might be like this? So I think there's a tremendous opportunity with these games. You might play these games tonight and not think about all those things. But you can stop and reflect, and we've really tried to embed tremendous opportunity inside these games, and we're going to be working with educators to help pull that out through curriculum.
There have been board game versions of Sid Meier's Civilization. If games like that can be huge hits, then maybe games like this as well, right?
I would love this game to be a huge hit. As a learning sciences person, my goal is to try to move forward learning. And also, if my goal is to sell, maybe my goal might be less to embed learning or to learn about learning. So my primary focus as a researcher is how do we learn about learning and bring these to populations. I would also say that when you're sitting with students in a formal or an informal learning environment, they're not looking to the same thing as the game they play when they're not. So there's already an understanding that, oh, all right, I'm going to play a math game, and it's more fun than me sitting there banging my head against the desk trying to do the math problem. So also thinking about the settings is also a little bit different as well.
Do they play Settlers of Catan at Baldo's Army?
No.
They don't?
They used to.
96, back in 96.
Yeah, by the way, the problem is...
We play Cities and Knights now.
Actually, I wanted to talk about Agricola, which is...
Agricola was highly influential on Lost and Found.
That's a game about farming.
Yes.
And
my mom says, what are you playing, that cooking game again?
And it is on the website Board Game Geek. It has the fame of being the highest rated game of all time. It has, when it came out, because ratings fall slowly over time, when it came out, it was the highest rated game and still is the highest rated game of all time. And you are farming, okay? In the day, Settlers was an incredibly popular game. And it was still getting regular play probably up to 2005. But, people want to try something new. And a lot of times, people come into my store to play games they haven't bought yet.
I see.
Because we have a big collection of newer games constantly, and people want to come in and try something before they buy it and bring it home.
Okay, by the way, I used to call it, I'm going to reveal something about me, but I don't care. You've listened to me enough on this talk show. We have to get to know each other. So our friends used to call it Settlers of Satan. We used to pronounce it with an S for a C, C for an S, because no one could say no, and it led to real division because no one would sleep. We'd play till about 4 a.m. So it was that I know the game well. So good luck with Lost and Found, by the way.
Thank you.
And
I try to use Settlers of Catan for people who don't have a lot of experience with Euro games. But I thank you for mentioning Agricola, because the historical detail that went into that game was a real inspiration for what we were doing.
It, by the way, that game is amazing, and you really are a couple with a farm. And you really are planting, harvesting, putting up fences, getting livestock. I mean,
it's kind of what they do in, what is it, Minecraft?
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean,
but this is a board game.
Yeah.
And it, you don't have to have, and this is one of the things when they talk about violent video games, there's a reason the designer is choosing to go that direction. and they don't have to. It's just easier for them.
See, I love this idea. I love the concept that you can still sell, that you can, that Agricola or whatever you pronounce that is. And by the way, it looks great, Jen. This is, your students are doing, this is their handiwork here?
We are very proud of them. Yes, yes. RIT is home now to the program that's ranked number 5 in the country by the Princeton Review for Game Design and Development. As Owen said, this is a team of about 30 students and faculty who worked on this, and they come from a variety of backgrounds above and beyond game design and development.
It looks outstanding.
The illustrators and graphic designers from CIAS, the College of Imaging Arts and Sciences, all of the architectural patterns are accurate to FUSTAT, so we work with scholars to work directly with those students, so yeah, definitely proud of all the work. This was about 3.5 years at RIT and about a year before I came to RIT. It's hard to make good games.
It is beautiful. Let's turn to the CEO of Second Avenue Learning, Victoria Van Voorhis, who, what is the is there sort of a magic formula that gets a game onto the market successfully? It's got to be, I would again assume it's got to be fun first. You can't just hit people on the head with values, and I would love to be able to hit people on the head with values, but what's the formula?
What value
for
is that, Evan?
Yeah, well, that's a fair question, Owen. But give me a sense for the creation process and how you try to get into the marketplace.
Well, Owen made a lot of really great points. So in entertainment games, you really have to focus on engagement and fun. And in learning games or serious games, you have this dual purpose of engagement and education. And the team that it takes to create that game is very different from an entertainment game. We have subject matter experts. We have teachers who are teaching at the grade level that our disciplines are associated with. We have artists. We have animators. We have game designers. We have coders. And we have quality assurance people that look not only at whether or not the game functions, but we have like editorial quality assurance to make sure everything is absolutely accurate. So it is a labor of love. And, you know, there's a variety of games that you can create. We can create a game that really looks at math fluency, like the game that we're building right now around using augmented reality to teach kids math. That's awesome, and it's a very simple game. Another kind of game is the side-scrolling platformer that we've created called Martha Madison, which invites kids into a problem space to invite them to learn about physics through play. And there, we've actually been able to do phenomenal research to show that after playing one session of Martha Madison, we can create a full letter grade improvement in kids' pre- and post-tests scores with standardized tests. They don't even know that they're actually learning. And we've been able to do things like close the vocabulary gap for people who come from a low socioeconomic background because they're actually being introduced to the language of science through play. And that helps them feel more confident and more interested and engaged in STEM. So if we look at anything from, you know, a fluency game to a problem-based game to one of our other titles that we did for the Landmark Society called Historical Friction, which actually makes you really engage in deep critical thinking, designing a game for learning is really tied to what the learning objective is and the problem that you're asking the learner to solve. Are you asking them to engage in critical thinking? Are you asking them to build fluency? Are you asking them to problem solve? And then from there, you go and you design. Marketing and selling educational games is much more challenging than marketing and selling entertainment games because you have to reach through many levels of purchasing decision. Districts, administrators, teachers, classrooms, parents, they all weigh in on that. And so one of the things that if people want to see more educational games, then they actually need to pay for educational games and not demand that serious game media be free because it's educational rather than not. And so if they actually would support the, you know, the 99 cents or the $2 that somebody's asking to charge for a serious game, you would see more people entering the marketplace and creating this content that has a different flavor than the games that our entertainment counterparts make. And there's a lot of great entertainment games out there. I don't want to take anything away from that art form. But the serious game art form is something that needs to be economically supported by the marketplace or, you know, it will attrit. And it's part of the reason that you don't see that balance in the sales stats.
All right, so we're running out of time here, but will educational ever put a dent in the entertainment genre of games?
I think it will.
You do? You believe it will? Not that it can, that it will happen.
Yes.
Okay, but this I think Victoria's making such an important point. You got to vote with your wallet. If you want this, if you value this, don't just demand that it is free. I think it's a great point. By the way, where can people get Second Avenue Games?
For Martha Madison, if you have a Steam membership, you can get them right on Steam. Otherwise, you can go to our website. And if you are interested in politics, I ask you to take a look at Voters Ed, which is on our website right now. We just won an award for Best Social Studies Education Interactive last week.
And so the website is?
www.secondavenuelearning.com.
Where can people find Lost and Found?
www.lostandfoundthegame.com. It's also available at Shop One at RIT, and we're thinking it might be available also soon
at the Strong National Museum of Play.
And I would say, keep in mind, it's going to be comparably priced to a tabletop hobby game. It's a lot more than $2, but if you're thinking about something like a Catan or an Agricola, it's in that market space. These are printed games that you can hold in your hand. And down the line, hopefully, we'll also have our digital prototype like the one we've built for the National Endowment for the Humanities.
And Alex White, where is Baldo's Armory?
We are located at 891 Monroe Avenue in the Upper Monroe neighborhood. And we're open afternoons, basically 2 till 10.
Games happening how often there?
Most evenings, we have some organized activity going on. My favorite one that I'd like to plug is actually an afternoon. We do a magic tournament for kids for free every Friday at 4 o'clock.
Every Friday?
Every Friday, 4 o'clock.
At Baldo's Armory on Monroe. Yep. Alex White from Baldo's. Great having you. Thank you for being back on the program here, Alex. Nice to see you. Thank you for having me. From RIT, Rabbi Dr. Owen Gottlieb, good luck with Lost and Found, Order in the Court, the party game, and Lost and Found. LostandFoundTheGame.com.
LostandFoundTheGame.com. Thanks.
See? I got it figured out here. And Jennifer Hinton, Assistant Director of the RIT Magic Center, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Victoria Van Voorhis, CEO of Second Avenue Learning, SecondAvenueLearning.com.
Correct.
If I have that correct.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being here as well. Great discussion this hour. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.